Good day. This is the making of the John Batso Show. Headline, Reuters, right now. Iran says it still controls Strait of Hormuz, not seeking talks after President Trump halts bombing. Subhead, Iran said in these hours, it was still in control of the Strait of Hormuz and not seeking to resume peace talks with the United States after President Trump halted a two-week bombing campaign that his brass told him had run its course. I welcome my colleague, Bill Raggio, senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Bill and I sigh when we see headlines that don't take us anywhere, so we're going to turn to the ambassador from Pakistan to the United States once upon a time, now senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, our man in diplomacy, Hussein Haqqani. Hussein, we need help. Bill and I do okay with the war fighting, but the pause for negotiation by diplomats that doesn't exist is a new one to us. Now, I know everything is everything has a purpose, so help us understand a good day to you. And just a moment, I'll start the program, and then we can take your explanation for diplomacy at hand. Here we go. Five.
Okay.
Just a moment, Hussein. I'm going to start us. Five. This is too precious. We're not talking, and therefore it's diplomacy. Five, four, three, two. Have I got everything running? Making sure, guys. Looks like I am. Yep. Good. One. Is that it? Yep. Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleagues, Hussein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and Bill Raggio. Oh, hold on. Oh. Come on, sailor. A visitor. Okay. One more time. Come on, guys. Cut it out. All right. There are only a few things that radio cannot handle, and one of them is barking dogs. Another one, barking dogs penetrate all layer of buffering. There's nothing they can do. Yeah, the bark is universal. I'm sure the canine developed that bark so that we could guarantee to be heard. Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleagues, Bill Raggio, senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, and Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Mr. Ambassador, I come immediately to you for guidance in interpreting present headlines from Europe. Reuters, in these hours, Iran says it still controls the Hormuz Strait. It is not seeking talks with the United States after President Trump halts bombing. Subhead doesn't get any better explanation. The president said Iran said it was not seeking to resume peace talks with the United States. However, President Trump halted a two-week bombing. His top brass told him had run its course, and the ambassador to the United Nations for the United States says we're giving diplomacy a chance. Mr. Ambassador, you are a professional diplomat. Help me understand the signaling here. We're not talking, but we're giving peace a chance. Good day to you.
Good day. Well, it's like a couple that says we are not about to get married, but we are seeing each other. Look, both Iran and the United States want a solution to the problem in which they got stuck. The U.S. has not been able to bring down the regime in Tehran. And Bill and I have spoken on your show several times to say that air power alone will not result in regime change or even in behavior change on the part of the regime. Here's a regime that doesn't mind losing people. It doesn't mind losing national assets. It doesn't mind losing infrastructure. It just wants to make the point that we are still standing. How do you win against them? On the other hand, President Trump's problem is that he cannot escalate it to the point where he will be able to launch a ground invasion. And yet he cannot appear to be giving in to the regime. So both of them have to say different things to their respective constituencies. At the same time, they want some kind of off-ramp. Iran doesn't want to be destroyed and to be hit further. And the United States doesn't want to end the war with a statement saying, oh, this was a futile war, but we fought it anyway. So they have to get something for it. And I am quite certain, and my sources tell me, that there are messages being exchanged, which is what happened the first time around. And if you remember, after many denials, sometimes from one side, sometimes from the other, we ended up having that meeting in Islamabad, and then subsequently that ceasefire and MOU, which was remotely signed. So I wouldn't be surprised if something is in the works and it will manifest itself in a few days.
Bill, a very good day to you. The interpretation is fair-minded about notes being passed back and forth. However, that begins the same process we've seen before with other negotiations. I remember the Taliban would deny that talks were taking place when we know now there were talks taking place. So part of the control here is the readiness of the military to continue the bombing and the defense of our allies in the Middle East. You've seen the same reports I have, Bill, about a depletion in our arsenal of interceptors, of everything. I could go through the list. It's a lot of hardware. Do you believe that the halting was on the basis of the arsenal and not on the basis of diplomacy? Have you had a sense of either one, Bill? Good day to you.
Good day, John. Good day, Hussein. First, I concur with Hussein. I believe there are some talks occurring behind the scenes. As far as the issue of depleted munitions, the Trump administration officials are saying this is bunk. But keep in mind, we have heard reports of this for quite some time. We've heard about U.S. munitions being in short supply due to supply of Ukraine, of previous conflicts in the Middle East related to Iran. And President Trump even said this himself when he initiated the ceasefire in April, I believe it was on April 8th, that, you know, that the continued strikes against Iran was depleting our stockpile. So I find it curious that administrations are so adamant that this is nonsense when we know there are shortfalls of munition. Was this the reason for the halt? I don't know. I suspect that the Trump administration is starting to learn that it can't bomb Iran into submission. Hussein is absolutely correct. You cannot win these wars via air. We should have learned these lessons way back in Vietnam, but we didn't. We failed to learn these lessons in Somalia, most recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, that without a significant presence on the ground, and I do not advocate for this in Iran, but if without a ground component, and that would have to be an Iranian resistance, as long as this regime could survive, it's willing to take the blows that are being delivered by the United States.
Ever more complicated, a headline from over the weekend from London. Ukraine's strike on Iranian tanker is a message for Trump, writes the Daily Telegraph. Kyiv hopes to turn U.S. president against Vladimir Putin by highlighting cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Of significance here is that Mr. Zelensky has announced that he will be visiting Britain to call on the new prime minister, Mr. Burnham of Manchester. And therefore, I credit this headline in the Telegraph because the Telegraph has a direct line from Parliament. When the Prime Minister wants a piece of information out that he can deny, you use either the Telegraph or the London Times, is my general understanding. But there's always an exception. Mr. Ambassador, let me get this straight. Ukraine attacks Iran to please the United States and in some way drive a wedge between Tehran and Moscow. Does that work for diplomacy? Thank you.
I'm not too sure. I mean, unless it's a sustained thing, events, look, there is a, in diplomacy often we say that some things are events and some things are a process. So if there is a process of Ukraine actually becoming a belligerent in this war, which may have consequences for Ukraine as well. Ukraine's real fight is with Russia. It's not with Iran. Let's be really honest from Ukrainian point of view. And Iranians are not going to not respond. I mean, that's who they are. So therefore, I personally feel this is more likely to be an event rather than a process. And if it does not become a process, then it will be just one of those one-off headline wonders.
It is true, though, that the Caspian Sea can be a battlefield, a very dangerous
Absolutely.
Battlefield.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that may have consequences for Ukraine because Russia wouldn't want that. And so instead of driving a wedge, it could actually get the Russians acting against Ukrainians in whatever they try to do in the Caspians as well, which will increase the losses that the Ukrainians are suffering. Bill knows war much better than I do. I think he will have something to say on this as well. Is Ukraine able to sustain something like that? Multiple directions of a war that it's fighting for its own survival.
Bill, I come to you about this apparent odd twist in the road, but I briefly mentioned that I've visited the Caspian Sea many times in these last years as a guest of the Azerbaijan sovereign state, which used to be part of the Soviet Union and is the original locator of the oil of the Middle East. That the Baku fields were so fertile that you didn't need to dig. It bubbled right up through the sand. And in the late Russian Empire, Baku and the surrounding area all the way down the Caspian Sea was covered with wood-built wood-built oil wells moving oil into Russia. Today, the oil wells are not as visible, but the Caspian Sea is one rich source of not only oil but natural gas, all of which is sent to Europe, or much of which is sent to Europe. Iran is participate in the Caspian Sea. Russia's in the Caspian Sea. Turkestan, Azerbaijan, I've named. We're talking about an extremely vulnerable area of the world. So given all that precedent, Bill, do you see the war escalating into the Caspian Sea? Is that something that's credible to you?
I mean, it's certainly credible. Is it likely? I say no. I'm with Ambassador Haqqani on this. I think this is more of an event and not a process. But there's certainly risks and reward involved. As Hussein had mentioned, the risk would be Iran getting pulled into that conflict even further. We all know that the Russians have been providing support to the Iranians. The Iranians have been providing support to the Russians with the drones. Is it wise for the Ukrainians to risk pulling in another actor? People can argue, well, the Iranians have their hands full with the United States. But I suspect this will be more of a localized event. I think this is more of a PR stunt by Zelensky to further induce President Trump to support Ukraine, to get the Iranian angle, highlight the Iran support for Russia. But let's keep in mind, all these reports that Russia is providing Iranians and Houthis targeting for U.S. I'm not saying that I like this, but the United States is providing targeting intelligence, satellite intelligence for the Ukrainians to launch strikes inside of Russia. Whatever the Russians have done, they haven't sponsored attacks inside the United States. So I think the Russians I can understand why they would want to inflict pain on the United States in the region. I don't like it as an American. I don't want to see this happening, but it isn't beyond the pale for Russia to do this, given the United States' support for Ukraine.
I'm speaking with Bill Rajo, a senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, and Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, a former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And when we come back, the word escalation that comes up now and again, is it real? Can you tell beforehand? I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and Bill Rajo, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Gentlemen, the word escalation is thrown down always as a warning. This looks like escalation. It could escalate. A threat as well to the countries participating. It's historically very difficult to tell, and we just debated, and there's no resolving this. However, you both have general sense of escalation. We've seen it certainly since 9/11, and we could date it back to late 20th century at the end of the Soviets when we turned to other disorders in the world. So, Mr. I ask you both to comment on the understanding. It would appear that the heat is being turned up in some fashion in Eurasia so that Iran and Ukraine are not separate subjects. We have a nuclear power, Russia, at war with a non-nuclear power, Ukraine, and no resolution. We have a nuclear power, the United States, at war with Iran, and no resolution. There's symmetry here. The puzzle is, what's next? Mr. Ambassador, your understanding of escalation, is it credible when it comes to the Iran-U.S. war? Does Mr. Trump have options? Does Iran have options that we've not now seen?
Well, I mean, Iran's option would be to escalate unconventional warfare across the region. It's already tried it. It activated Hezbollah against Israel. It has activated the Houthis. It could do some other damage of that sort. But they are primarily masters at unconventional warfare rather than direct attack. The United States is too far for them to attack, so they will only attack America's allies and its interests. But where they have an advantage is that they are holding the global economy hostage through their actions in the Red Sea via the Houthis and directly in the Straits of Hormuz. Now, as far as U.S. is concerned, the U.S. has to be very concerned both about the economic consequences of escalation, but also about drawing other actors who at this moment are probably on America's side, but may not necessarily stay on America's side because they have other interests to pursue. Just to give you an example, the Caspian Theater is particularly of interest to Turkey as well. Which has a particular partnership and alliance with Azerbaijan. Then whenever Azerbaijan gets involved, Armenia gets involved. So do you want to have this cascading effect in which various people start getting involved for their various interests, which is why President Trump has, notwithstanding rhetoric, kept it as a U.S.-Iran conflict. He hasn't... even if he tried, he hasn't succeeded in getting various Arab countries. Kuwait only the other day denied Wall Street Journal reports about Kuwait attacking Iranian targets because they don't want to do that. Everybody wants to say, no, we are not we are out of this war. Please don't target us. And so in a situation like that, escalation only means America increases the frequency of its aerial bombardment of Iran. And Bill and I have already said that is not going to be enough to achieve the war aims.
Bill, your thoughts about escalation from the United States side. Eliminating the nuclear option here, I hope, I'm assuming. Is there any more that could be done with hardware or software than we're not now doing? We have 30 seconds, Bill.
Yeah, and yet again, I have to agree with Hussein. There's very little that I think the U.S. can do to escalate short of putting its own boots on the ground. And I do not advocate this. The irony that the countries like Kuwait don't want to attack Iran because they don't want to be attacked by Iran while they're being attacked by Iran. I hope that's not lost on anyone, but that's the nature of these states. They want to de-escalate. They want this fighting to stop because it's hurting their bottom line. And that's the dilemma that President Trump faces. So that's why I don't see things escalating beyond where they are. Again, the U.S. can increase strikes, but the reality is, as long as this regime persists, it will be a problem.
Bill Raggio, Hussein Haqqani, I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, Hussein. Thank you.
Good show, by the way, and quite fast moving. I mean, we had a lot to say, and we commented on a lot. But at the same time, we did it in relatively short time.
I bit my tongue about the president's triteness over the weekend. I just bit my tongue. It doesn't help anybody for us to repeat the obvious. So I thank you both for going to places that you saw the ambassador to the United States on television, or at least if you reviewed what he said, complete contradictory stuff, Bill. Admitted our arsenal was depleted and then said people should go to jail who are leaking it.
Yeah, it's... They really should just learn to look at their past statements. Like, it's someone, should be someone's job to just ignore the... Look, if you don't like it.
Yeah, may I, you know, at the risk of sounding like somebody who's too critical of this administration, let me just say that the fact that this administration is not a conventional administration actually makes it a very irresponsible administration in some ways, because the conventional administration, every official, when he makes a statement, it's vetted, it's framed. Here the president grabs a headline here, then another there, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, by the way, that is impeding the diplomatic process, because he says one day, yeah, well, if the Iranians start collecting money for ships to pass the Straits of Hormuz, maybe America will collect its share. And of course, without realizing the consequence in that statement, he has authorized them to collect money. And then he has to go back on it. And the same thing. So you can't run a country, let alone the world, just by headline grabbing statements and comments that get you applause from your little Amen corner for that particular moment. You have to have a plan. You have to think things through. And that usually involves more than one person.
Everything you say is... If you review what the president posted at True Social over the weekend, you will be flabbergasted. I guarantee you, flabbergasted. It is the provocation of a 12-year-old. It's not just uninformed. It's trite, and the office is posting this as official communication to us. It's.
Every statement from the president is an official communication. That's the problem here. And now, if I may, very well-disciplined communication campaigns could still look awful as well. Look at our withdrawal from Afghanistan and how the Biden administration handled that. They were on the message, same message. Now, both are bad, and I'm not saying one for the other. It's just you can have a highly disciplined messaging campaign and still look foolish and still look weak.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so, but we've just had all levels of
incompetence. And foolish. And one thing that is not partisan in the United States is foolishness. That's a bipartisan quality right now.
There's one thing you could count on. Both sides will mess up the messaging and both sides will fail to communicate properly to the American public the importance of these conflicts.
You're being generous, Bill, and I want to use an analogy from my youth. If Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson or Jimmy Carter during the Vietnam tragedy, and it was, a million people lost their lives in Vietnam on the Vietnamese side, at least, we have no count. It was the curse of a generation. Agent Orange destroyed babies, made people live with children who were profoundly damaged. If any one of those presidents or those secretaries of state had posted anything in the distant connection to what we're now seeing from the president today routinely, they would have been drummed out of court. I'll be general about this. I'm not going to be specific about constitutional duty. They would have been disregarded for the rest of their lives. They would have been removed from people's lists of who to ask questions about if anyone had come close to what the president is now posting. So have we normalized his conduct, Mr. Ambassador? Is that what?
We have normalized his conduct, and the other side's conduct has been normalized as well. So, and the country is so divided that you just can't talk. I mean, like, for example, we saw it just now. The moment, you know, everybody feels compelled to make the statement that, yes, he did this, but the others did that, because that's what this country has become. It's all about, it's not, and the result is, and people dislike the others so much. Those who support him don't support him. They dislike the other side and vice versa. And we are not finding solutions.
I do not want to do the whataboutism thing. To me, it's a critique of both parties, as Hussein said.
President Biden,
you know, we were told after it was very clear that he was not fit to be president, that it doesn't matter who's the president. It's the people that are under him that matter. I mean, so yeah.
Well, now we don't have people under him because right. There is no people under him. People under him just echo what he says, and if they don't, then you know he treats them like a school bully. You know, if you don't exactly say what I say, I'm like those videos of people praising him in cabinet meetings in language that is reminiscent of what happens in North Korea. You know, the sun shines out of your ears, sir, and maybe some other places, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody's trying to fall over each other to say those things. There's a triteness in American political discourse, I'm afraid, that we will have to figure out how to get rid of. And it's not just about him. It's about overall, a lot of people say irresponsible things these days.
Yeah. Yes, they do. But this, the level of triteness over the weekend, there are other words to condemn it, but it's not consistent with the business, the very serious business of a government of the United States, because the president has the ability to end people's lives and destroy cities. And you don't put into place a 12-year-old, a troubled 12-year-old, to make those decisions. It's not fair-minded. And I remind everyone who has doubts about what is to be done, we do not have an easy mechanism. It's very carefully written so that it's not easy. The statement in the 25th is unable. That's all it is. It doesn't say unqualified, unfit. It says unable, presuming that the president was damaged or unhealthy in some fashion. He couldn't make decisions. But what we have right now is the situation where the president is clearly signaling us that he's unfit. He's telling us. But we can't do anything about it because of the restrictions of the 25th, unless one man could make a decision, and that's the vice president. He has the power to move the story, even though the 25th is not written conveniently for him. And right now, we're told the vice president, in reporting this morning, is conveying to the president in limited fashion how that we're troubled about Iran. We're told that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is telling the president in limited fashion that the arsenal is depleted. We're told that they're telling him what we know to be true. It doesn't mean that they're giving us a way forward. But gentlemen, we've got a war where we went to war without a goal, and now we're in the war and we have no exit. Bill, that's the definition of madness.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We from day one, we questioned what is the end goal, and nobody has really, it's been all over the place. Still wondering.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for this. Mr. Ambassador, we look to your comments next Monday. Thank you for joining us.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Well, Hussein.
Bill, we're moving on to Gaza.
Got it.
Another intractable, unsolved situation for how many decades now? I have a picture of Che Guevara in Gaza. That's how long we've been doing this.
We got to be more than 50 years now, right?
Oh, 50 years. Yeah, easily. And, you know, given that Gaza dates back to the 14th century BCE, we could, you know, I'll give you 500 years and raise you 500.
I was thinking the modern conflict versus the Israeli state, but sure, yes. I mean, certainly.
When I saw Che Guevara visiting Gaza in 59, I gave up. I threw my hands up. I go, you got me, guys. Things.
If only they were just communists.
The Cuban Revolution in Gaza, with the UN delivering. So we're going to turn to Gaza. Let me see. Is Sam? Yes, Sam's here. Wonderful. So, welcome, Sam. Well, good day to you.
Morning. How are you guys?
Well, we're cheerful because we've been dealing with insolvable matters. So we thought, well, let's find another insolvable matter. And we just happened to have Sam Benner. Sam, what I'd like, Bill, with your permission, I'd like to outline why I'm watching Gaza so carefully. There's a sense to me that the Hamas is gaining in confidence because it knows it's watching what's happening in Iran. And it knows that no matter how much violence is visited upon it and the targeted killings and the threats, what it has to do is refuse to surrender, which is what Iran's doing. And at some point in future, there will be something emerging that is Hamas as before. So, Sam, I'd like your, first of all, the report on the targeted killings. I think there was more than one, but I lose count over the over these last days. Then I'd like the status of the Gazans themselves and what we believe the number is inside, where they are, who's feeding them, who's responsible for feeding them. Then I'd like a report on the Board of Peace, if anything. If there's no activity, we want to hear that there's no activity. And then...
Yeah, there's been a bit.
The leadership of Iran, the leadership of Hamas is said to now be in refuge circumstances in Turkey. Does that mean they're outside of the target zone for Israel? That's another question I've had. Because when they were in Qatar, they were not outside the target zone for Israel. Does being under Erdogan's hospitality make them exempt? So, Bill, is that all agreeable?
And of course, absolutely.
All right, I want this 9 minutes for tonight, Sam, and thank you for joining us. We'll start right away.
Okay.
No barking dogs here. You notice how they calmed down, Bill. That was all about somebody visiting who might have treats in his pocket.
My wife just got a new kitten last week, so I'm waiting for him to jump up and join the program. So
oh, we'll definitely, see. Yes. Make friends with you, yes. They love the idea of performing in front of the video. All right, here we go.
Sitting on laptops.
Yep. Five. Thank you, Sam. Set 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, continues with me as my colleague and co-host to help me understand the intractable matter of Gaza. We are very pleased to have someone watching Gaza for us carefully. Sam Benner of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy routinely updates us on a story that is not lost, but certainly nowhere near the front page coverage it achieved since 23, especially during the worst of the fighting when they were still negotiating over hostages, living and dead, to be returned. Sam, a very good day to you. I've seen headlines, not taken notes on them, over the last days of IDF strikes in Gaza on what are said to be leaders, combat leaders of Hamas. How many were there? Who were they? And what is the significance of these strikes? Good day to you, Sam.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back on. The first one we probably want to talk about is Wael al-Ladawi, who is Hamas's internal security service commander within central Gaza. Something to note is that Israel has at this point basically taken out every single upper echelon military leader within Gaza. So all that's left for them to target are these sort of high ranking, but, you know, not necessarily would have been trusted before people who are important to Hamas's day-to-day functioning, more so than their long-term strategic goal. So he was the head of basically Hamas's internal police force. They were responsible for shutting down the planned protests about 2 weeks ago. They also took out another Hamas police commander. This guy was a brigadier general. And I'm going to butcher his name, but Abdul Aser Makadma as well. Those are the two biggest ones that Israel targeted over the last few weeks, and both of them were Hamas internal security members. So maybe that shows that, you know, the IDF had good intel on both of these guys at the same time, or perhaps they're going after Hamas's ability to impose its rule on the Gazan people.
And where were they hit? In a particular part of Gaza, outside of Gaza, what do we know about the strike?
I believe Makadma was in the north and Ladawi was in central Gaza. And from what I understand, and I have to caveat anything I say with, I had never heard of these guys before they were taken out because they weren't high ranking officials before this, but now they're some of the highest ranking people left in Gaza. However, it's at the organizational point where there are dozens, if not more, of these figures. So it's hard to keep track, but it seems as if they were the two people leading Hamas's police force or internal security mechanism. It's the same thing, but in the north and central Gaza. And yeah, Hamas really isn't in a ton of southern Gaza because the IDF has taken control of a lot of that area, and that falls within their side of the LOI.
So these were security elements who very well could have been involved in the murder of Gazans for being suspect of betraying Hamas. These could have been executioners. Is that correct?
Maybe they didn't do it personally. I can guarantee I'd put money that they gave orders to do this at a large scale, including, you know, how there have been reports recently that Hamas has been torturing people inside of hospitals as a way to sort of get their more disgusting activities out of the direct eye line of the IDF. I wouldn't be surprised if these guys were personally involved.
Bill, you have a question for Sam.
Well, good morning, Sam. Is Israel, the IDF, striking at locations where Hamas security officials or the actual operatives, the security forces, are gathering in addition to hitting the leadership? Or is this just a targeted campaign against the leadership?
Certainly a targeted campaign against the leadership. I only saw details on the Dawi, but they got him in his apartment. He happened to be meeting with another one of his deputies at that time, so they got him too. But certainly the IDF knows who these people are and are going after them intentionally. You'll also see almost every week a couple terrorists who the IDF says participated in October 7th. And they have good details on exactly what it is they did, if they took or held hostages, what place in Israel they went to on October 7th. And then they'll kill a couple of these guys a week, basically, which means they're certainly targeting them.
Go ahead. Hamas announcing the deaths of these leaders, of these fighters?
I haven't seen them do that. The IDF's pretty good, so I don't have a need to, but I don't think that they are. They haven't been doing that for most of the war. And we can remember it took them, I think, 3-4 months to say when Mohammed Daif was killed.
Yeah.
So I doubt that they're doing that now. And at this point, I think everyone's just kind of used to it and it has become desensitized.
The Board of Peace, any activity there, Sam?
More so on Israel's side, but it is about a Board of Peace initiative. Israel approved, I think, about 200 International Stabilization Force soldiers to go into Gaza at some point and administer. These troops would be mostly from Morocco and then some from Uganda. This is an important step for the pilot zones that we talked about last week, because the idea of it is Israel will not administer the internal security within the zone. That would be done by the ISF, and then eventually a Palestinian police force. So things are moving slowly, and they gave an initial timeline of a couple of weeks for these things to be set up. And if Israel is only just approving the ISF, this ISF deployment now, that means it's still a long way away. But that is a positive step forward, and yeah, potentially the ISF could have a couple hundred people, which I thought it would have zero.
Bill, you have a question.
Yeah, from what countries are these hundreds of the ISF security personnel being approved from?
Mostly Morocco, a bit of Uganda. And what's important about this is Israel has to approve individually every single country that wants to send troops and which troops, because there are a lot of people who want in on the ISF if it does exist, and they have many different motivations. I think you'd be hard pressed for Israel at this point, given the coldening of relationships with Turkey, to put it lightly. If Turkey wanted to send troops to the ISF, which they've said they wanted to do, I don't think Israel would let that happen. Certainly, they wouldn't let Qatari troops or, you know, maybe Saudi Arabian troops if they joined the Abraham Accords. But there are a lot of people who Israel would want to keep out, so they have to approve each one of these deployments holistically. But now they've approved at least two countries' proposed deployments.
Gaza is wholly dependent upon food from the outside. Do we know who's administering the food? Do we have any security of the food once it enters Gaza? And how much is going in every day? Do we know what the number is?
So we actually just got from COGAT, which is the Israeli aid distribution system or network, They have said that since the ceasefire, they've given 1.8 million tons of food to Gaza, or at least administered and screened it. That would be three times as much as the World Food Program recommends going to meet basic humanitarian needs. We've also been looking at food prices, which have dropped in Gaza by about 72% since the ceasefire started, which is a good sign. Certainly a lot of aid is going into Gaza. In terms of who's administering it, that would be Hamas. It is not free. It's never been free for Gaza, which I think makes it not humanitarian. Although, you know, the UN isn't getting the profit, so they can still get the tax exempt status, I'm sure.
So Hamas is the food? Is that, or once it's inside, yeah. Hamas controls the food. Is that still correct, Sam?
Yeah, that was true since the beginning of the war, and it's still true now. Nothing has been done since the GHF to change the way the distribution system works. This is how Hamas gets the majority of their money at this point, since Israel has also been going after their money lenders and international financial networks. So this remains Hamas's piggy bank. But there is more food going in, and there is not starvation or even claims of starvation at this point.
Samuel Benner for the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, my colleague and co-host Bill Raggio. I'm John Batchelor. Don't see a lot of headlines about how Hamas runs the food market.
Yeah.
Once upon a time.
No. Inconvenient truth.
Bill, that sounds like a nightmare. They're just waiting to get back. Once the Israelis leave and the Moroccans move in, how long is it going to take to buy them off, Bill?
Yeah, you know, Morocco's an interesting one. The Israelis approve them. I would be concerned about that.
This would be for the pilot zone, not for for the pilot zone. Yeah, I maybe should have made that more clear.
Okay.
I know it's for the pilot zone.
But still, right? You know, it's still an area where just looking in the other way is enough.
And
as far as Arab countries go, I there's few better than Morocco. UAE would be better.
I agree. Morocco is not a concern, but individually.
Bill, Morocco's putting a target on its back.
Yeah. Well, they're a long reach. I mean, whoever wants to go to Morocco, that's quite the stretch. They do have the distance.
Oh, I've been to Morocco. Come on. it's a great country.
You know, what can Hamas do to Morocco at this point? What can Iran do to Morocco? You know?
Yeah, they're very insulated. They should be more worried about Spain,
if
you ask me.
All right, rosy scenario. Thanks, right. Sam. Thanks for an update. We don't get anywhere anymore except for you, Sam.
Okay, well, I'm happy to come on
and
whenever
the question I didn't get to ask, is the leadership in Turkey considered protected?
So I would say yes. The only way is like a covert assassination, but even that would be violation. The only thing is Hamas or Turkey would have to go to bat for Hamas publicly in that case when Israel doesn't claim responsibility. But they, you know, I think they're itching for a fight. They might do it. So I don't think Israel is going to take that risk necessarily.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not going to bomb it like they did Qatar. It's that they're in NATO. Can't do it.
Yeah, the Turks can cause far, far more problems for Israel than just hosting Hamas's leadership.
Okay.
Exactly.
The Qataris, you know, they'll have a reach.
Thank you, Sam, and thanks, Bill. Bill, I'll be back with you at 9:30 with Caleb, and we'll go to Africa.
Perfect. Catch you then.
Thank you, Sam.
Be well. Hey,
thank you, gentlemen. This is the Friends of History Debating Society Part 2. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. About to take a break. The orchestra's here. I have to pay them, you know, when they're on early, I have to pay them extra, just like when they're on late. I hope they forgive me. Here we go.